listening to the Night Demon Network. Go to nightdemon.net/subscriber to unlock more exclusive content.
Buzz. Every weeknight, it's Buzz After Dark.
You like that?
With Eric Steele.
Hang out with me Monday through Friday from 7 to midnight for the Buzz After Dark. It's kind of like the Titanic, except instead of 3 hours to sink, it takes 5 hours.
Freaks come out at night, that's for sure. The Buzz After Dark.
After Dark.
All night long.
Awesome tunes, clothing optional.
Hope you enjoyed the ride.
Weeknight 7 to midnight on 102.9 The Buzz.
Bill's Rock Station.
Night Demon fans and friends, we are calling upon you to get Welcome to the Night added to rotation on 102.9 The Buzz. Text the Buzz hotline at area code 615-399-1029 to request Night Demon's Welcome to the Night. That's area code 615-399-1029. You know what to do.
Hello, and welcome to the Night Demon Heavy Metal Podcast. I'm your host, Nesbitt. In October of 2016, the Frost and Fire 2 Festival was held in Ventura, California. Headlining the two-day 20-band festival was Cirith Ungol, performing their first show in over 25 years. What the audience was witnessing was more than just a metal festival. It was the triumphant rebirth of the godfathers and innovators of metal in Ventura, California. This is the story of Cirith Ungol, a band born before their time. It's a tale of their rise and their tragic fall into self-imposed exile. But it's also the story of two bands, Night Demon and Cirith Ungol, and the friendship between the two bands that led to Cirith Ungol's resurrection and return to the world's metal stage. This is the story of Cirith Ungol. Cirith Ungol is a band. They're born before their time. They emerged from the 1970s hard rock, progressive rock tradition, but they forged their own path of heavy, doom-laden metal, which at the time had no template. Here's the members of Night Demon: Armand, Jarvis, and Dusty.
They're definitely a unique band. I mean, I wouldn't say that it's like anything that I can really compare them to. There's anything I can compare them to. You know, there's just a bunch of influences. And, you know, the sound of Tim's vocal, I think vocals are very unique, especially for that time. It's funny. I think, like, they're really heavy as far as, not like in a way like Black Sabbath is with, you know, they're tuned down really low and stuff like that. I think it's more of just the doom aspect and the lyrics and the, you know, the artwork, which is a huge, huge part of their thing. You know, that, all that stuff together just makes it, you know, heavy, besides the sound, you know?
You know, I'll just be completely transparent and completely honest about it. I was not a fan of the band. In my later years of playing, when I actually listened to the band, when I was actually able to, you know, when I was a little older and I had some money and I was able to get my hands on some of these records, you know, or I had worked in a record store in my late teens and early 20s, and I had access to all kinds of stuff. The guy who owned the record store had basically shut down his store for 10 years and had everything in storage. And when he reopened it, I helped him reopen it. He just had all of this great metal from the 80s that he had just not sold yet. And so I was able, I mean, I got access to so many great records, and I was able to listen to that Sirith Ungol stuff. And I just don't think that my ears were mature enough then. And I just was so in the mode of, you know, modern production. I wanted all my metal to sound like the Black Album. You know, like this was in the later 90s when I was listening to them, and a lot of the new metal stuff had been coming out, and like, you know, I mean, say what you want about that scene. It's definitely not going to be looked back on as, you know, and like the glory years of metal, definitely not. But the production of those records was just something that, like, I was like, wow, these bands just sound extremely powerful and extremely heavy. And it was just modern studio tricks and stuff like that. But I hadn't known that. And my ears were kind of tuned to that. I mean, even Metallica around that time, I mean, when they put out the covers album, the Garage Inc. record, I mean, it just sounds so good. I mean, the newer tracks that they did, I mean, the studio production is just so powerful. And my ears were just kind of used to that. And I was young and I was playing music and I was trying to go in the direction of sounding as powerful as I could. So listening to older music back then, if it wasn't the new wave of British heavy metal stuff, it just sounded weak to me. And especially listening to Frost and Fire and King of the Dead at the time, which are two amazing records, I just didn't know at the time. I couldn't get into it. I couldn't get into Tim's vocals. It was just too different for me. The same thing happened with me, though, when I listened to King Diamond for the first time. I mean, it just took me years to be able to get into King's vocals. I just thought it was cheesy. I thought it was silly. And it just didn't do anything. It wasn't pleasing to the ear, you know? And with Sirith Ungol, the recording quality of those records, I mean, now, these days, I can appreciate bad recording quality. Like when I got into the old Misfits stuff, when I first heard the Misfits stuff, I know Armand talked about this in a previous episode, but it's just like, what is this dog shit? You know? And then your ear gets used to it. And you're like, oh, it's like nowadays I like listening to demos kind of more than I like listening to some polished studio albums, because I can hear the realness in them. And I really appreciate that now. But at the time, I just, again, I think my ears were not as mature.
Funny enough, the first time, you know, I feel like I had seen that name around growing up around Oxnard, you know, in high school and stuff like that. But for some reason, I never heard their music. And I remember getting there's a book called The Encyclopedia of Heavy Metal. I got it for Christmas one year, and it's like a big, like, kind of coffee table book thing. And, you know, it's like fucking every band from A to Z. And most of them have a picture and a biography. You know, the bigger bands have a whole page and all that. But sure enough, under C is this band called Sirith Ungol. And I saw that, you know, they were from Ventura. And it was in this book, you know, next to fucking Judas Priest and Metallica and, you know, Iron Maiden and all the best of the best, and, you know, the worst of the worst, obviously, because it's an encyclopedia of heavy metal. So they really made sure everybody was in there. So that was where I first heard about them or learned about them. And even at that point, I still had no idea what their music sounded like or anything like that.
Well, I worked a gig for Night Demon, actually. It must have been like either 2012, maybe 2013 at the latest. The band had played a show at a place in Ventura called Billio's. And this was back when John was playing drums and Brent was in the band, obviously. And we went to a little Italian restaurant across the street from Billio's for dinner. And the Cirith Ungol promo picture was up on the wall. And I think Jarvis and Brent pointed it out saying, hey, look, there's Cirith Ungol. They're from Ventura. They're like these, you know, local legend, you know, metal band that was signed to Metal Blade. And it sounded like they were kind of a big deal. And I was thinking to myself, like, how come I'd never heard of these guys before, you know? And I think either Brent might have had some records or maybe even Pat Bailey when he was, they might have been talking about him having some Cirith Ungol records. So, yeah, I mean, that was my introduction to them at that point. And really, I, you know, had no idea who the band was. They were pretty ahead of their time. I think they were pretty misunderstood. So that's probably why they weren't ever really, you know, a mainstream band on top of other things. Yeah, so that's kind of when I became aware of that because I obviously grew up in Pennsylvania and I moved to Ventura in 2010. So it was a couple years after that that I heard about Cirith Ungol. So I was pretty novice to the whole idea of the band.
I became aware of the name Cirith Ungol at a very young age. I would say probably between ages 9 and 12, maybe something around there. In the late 80s and the early 90s, I had friends that had older brothers that were always turning us on to music. A lot of hardcore punk stuff like the Nardcore scene, the stuff from Oxnard and Ventura, the area that we come from. I remember I had a tape from Ill Repute, their album What Happens Next. But I used to see flyers a lot with Cirith Ungol's name on it. They pretty much retired right when I started to go to shows. So I never did see the band back then or really hear them. I mean, there was no internet and stuff. I do remember seeing their name in some copies of some old metal magazines and Sounds magazine and stuff that I had. And actually, their name had kind of been associated with some stuff with the new wave of British heavy metal, which I was really getting into through the avenues of Metallica. Because that was pretty much my gate. Metallica was my gateway into everything back then when I was really young. But it's just crazy, like seeing a band's name somewhere in a magazine or on in a photograph with somebody wearing a T-shirt. It kind of just sticks with you. But other than that, there used to be every 4th of July downtown, there's a big street fair, like 4th of July kind of street fair parade thing. And my parents used to take me down there and I used to go to all the thrift stores downtown. And there was always a copy of Frost and Fire in all the record stores and the thrift stores. Sometimes in the dollar bin, there was just so many copies of this thing floating around. So I had always seen it, you know, physically, but didn't know what it sounded like. The art was really cool, but I never did buy it. So I didn't really hear the band until later. But I do remember at the time, just a lot of the old school punk guys kind of just talking down about Cirith Ungol. I mean, it was kind of a thing where in the small town of Oxnard, Ventura, California, it's very rich in the hardcore punk scene and kind of like the working class musician scene. And Cirith Ungol to those guys were just thought of as just another one of these 80s heavy metal bands that, you know, were excessive, like the hair metal Motley Crue kind of thing. They didn't really understand what the band was about and what it was all about. But, you know, I mean, the Cirith Ungol guys took pride in their equipment. And, you know, Rob Garvin's always been known for having just an amazingly huge drum kit and stuff. And I think a lot of the punks at the time kind of looked down on that. And, you know, you got to understand in that era, punk and metal just did not mix. It wasn't until probably the super late 80s when bands like the Cro-Mags started to play more of a metal style, or you had bands like DRI that were doing crossover and Thrash Zone or Corrosion of Conformity, like really where the punk and metal kind of started to mix. But back then, I mean, even if you had long hair and you went to a punk show, you run the risk of actually getting beat up. Just crazy shit like that. I'm glad these days that that has changed a lot in the scene. But really, I mean, I had already known that Cirith Ungol was kind of like, they were more kind of a local band. I didn't know at the time how widespread their music had been and what kind of impact they had made, because back at home, it just didn't matter. I mean, it really wasn't a big deal. And myself now as the manager of the band, I'm kind of like the guy whose stuff gets passed along to preserve. And, you know, in my office, I have these newspaper articles framed, just things of saying like, hey, supposedly these guys have a large audience around the world, but, you know, where are the hometown fans? Why is nobody coming to see this band at home? Why are they getting no traction here at home? You know, why is the band not touring out here? Why hasn't that happened? Where are all the fans here? So that's what we grew up around.
Timing too, man. I think that their sound was kind of, either it was too throwback, you know, to the like 70s kind of like heavy metal, or it was too modern for what was going on in the time when they were active in the 80s and stuff. I mean, you know, you get all the hair metal shit and the thrash metal, and they were neither of that. You know, they were more of a kind of a doom band, I think, before that kind of stuff came back around and got popular. Yeah, I think it was just one of those kind of wrong place at the wrong time, and people just couldn't understand their shit. Because I also don't think that they really got popular, you know, until later on.
You have to put into context how the world worked then. It's not like how it is now. There is a huge barrier to entry to everything. And unless something was right in front of your face, you really didn't know, unless somebody sat you down and explained it to you, what something was about, or what a scene was about, or what a band was doing, or what was holding a band back. And you just didn't know. You just kind of like, if somebody told you one thing about a band, their opinion, you kind of, that's just kind of what you thought for the rest of your life until you heard otherwise. You just kind of trusted the opinion of whoever told you what. So we have all this information now at our fingertips, and we have social media and the internet, and we could just get out there and at the click of a button, just find out the entire history about something and get a wide array of opinions about it from the public around the world. So I think that we were actually at a disadvantage from being local to what was happening, because we didn't have the opportunity to see it up close and personal at the time when we were young.
All hail, Night Demon Heavy Metal Podcast listeners. This is Dusty Squires chiming in to tell you about my brand new signature sticks from the London Drumstick Company. I've dreamt of having my very own drumsticks ever since I was a wee lad, and LDC made that a possibility for me. Founded in 2016 in London, England, the birthplace of heavy metal, the London Drumstick Company has trailblazed a path through the music industry and taken the drummer world by storm. When I met them for the first time, they knew their product was going to withstand the beatings of a Night Demon show. They took the time to work with me on getting everything just right. The balance and weight of my sticks are the same no matter what, and the durability is bar none the best I've ever had. I know my sticks will last through the set night after night. I'm truly honored to work with a company that caters to their players the way LDC does. Their innovation and attention to detail is what separates them from the rest of the stick makers out there. Their custom stick sleeves are unbelievable and really make the entire presentation complete. Wait until you see the design they came up with for me. It blew my mind and was a surprise to say the least. They have all kinds of amazing swag, including hoodies, t-shirts, drummer shorts, drum keys, stick bags, towels, face masks, practice pads, and much, much more. Even if you're not a drummer, you can be a part of Demon History and order my brand new signature sticks direct from their website. How cool is that? And to top it off, the London Drumstick Company are giving an exclusive offer to the Night Demon Heavy Metal Podcast listeners. Go to londondrumsticks.co.uk and receive a 15% store-wide discount using promo code DEMONSTICKS. All capital letters, no spaces, DEMONSTICKS. DEMONSTICKS. I can't thank everyone there enough for the opportunity to be a part of their family and for them trusting me with their amazing products. See you metal maniacs on the road very soon. And yes, the wood chips will be flying.
Sirith Ungol has been around for over 45 years. They were formed in 1972, and to put that into context, one of their first gigs was an anti-Vietnam War rally. So they formed in a time when there was no metal scene at all, really, in Ventura. Here's Rob Garvin, drummer and founding member of Sirith Ungol.
There wasn't much of a metal scene as you know it today in our small town of Ventura, California. Ventura is a beach town, and it's around, 100 miles north of Los Angeles and maybe 30 miles south of Santa Barbara. The music scene consisted mainly of only several clubs and bars. However, there was a local promoter, Jim Souser, who had a really cool music store in town. Matter of fact, we bought one of our very first professional amplifiers from him back in the day. And he would bring in bands and put on concerts, some here in Ventura, some up in Santa Barbara. But he brought bands such as Led Zeppelin, Jimi Hendrix, The Doors, and Iron Butterfly. I was too young to get into those concerts at the time, being around 13. However, it didn't stop Jerry Gregg and me from listening to that music and being inspired by it. You know, and our dream was to get out there and play just like these big bands that we were seeing the posters to and hearing about.
Here's Greg Lindstrom, guitar player and also founding member of Sirith Ungol.
So Sirith Ungol started from the band Titanic. They started that in the summer after eighth grade. And I knew Rob from seventh grade. So he called me and they got me in, I think, because I had a guitar and an amp mainly. But anyway, we played mostly all Beatles tunes, probably about 40 different Beatles tunes, which I wasn't that into. And a little bit of Creedence Clearwater. We had at first, we had three guys playing guitar plugged into one amp, and Rob had a snare, just had a snare drum and a hi-hat. Eventually, he got a full drum set, though, and I actually bought a bass. So we played a Titanic for about 6 months, I think. And myself and Rob and Jerry, we wanted to play heavier stuff like Cream and Mountain. So we quit Titanic and formed Sirith Ungol, and that was in... When we were in ninth grade, probably the spring of 72, I think.
Here's the late Jerry Fogel, guitarist and founding member of Sirith Ungol, from a 1982, never-before-released interview.
Well, I started playing guitar in fourth grade. I heard the Beatles, and ever since then, I've been interested in rock. I've never really gotten over wanting to do anything else. Some of my main influences, Ritchie Blackmore, Deep Purple, Tony Iommi, Black Sabbath, others that are too numerous to mention, really. I'm influenced by everything. And I met Robbie in seventh grade in junior high school, and we met the others soon after that, and we've all had the same goal.
Our goal was to play the heaviest metal known to man. We holed up in an upstairs bedroom in my parents' house, and for years we wrote and recorded music, honing our songwriting skills and style into what would become what is easily recognized today.
So Rob and Greg, along with other founding member and guitarist Jerry Fogle, form the band and take their name, Cirith Ungol, from J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. It actually means spider's cleft in the Elvish language that's used in the novels, which is kind of fitting because co-founding members Garvin and Lindstrom, they met in a seventh grade English literature class. And a lot of their lyrics of the band in the future would continue to deal with literary fantasy themes. So with no metal scene really existing in Ventura, Cirith Ungol was really instrumental in bringing heaviness to the area. Here's Rob with some info about those early gigs back in the day.
The early gigs of Cirith Ungol were quite special, and I'll share a couple of them with you. Our local city had a recreation department that would put on these mini pop festivals. You got to remember back at the time, Woodstock was happening and festivals all over the country. And so what they were trying to do is to try to organize some kind of events so that younger teenagers could go hang out at and have fun with. Not more than like, you know, a mile from my house right now, where we went to Ventura High School, there was a big stadium, Larrabee Stadium. They put on one of these mini pop festivals there, which we actually have some pretty cool photographs from. And I think altogether, maybe, you know, 100 people showed up, sit out on a giant football field. A couple of wooden stages were set up. You know, we brought our own amps, and they supplied a PA or a sound system. And we played, and that was pretty amazing experience. Another one was there was a local club downtown Ventura. It's gone now, but it was called Louis Life. We played two nights there. We opened up for a band, Ball and Jack. And what I really remember about that was the guys in Ball and Jack were very cool to us. You know, and we hadn't played too many real shows at the time. And I remember one of the guys telling me they just got off tour with Jimi Hendrix Experience. He said that he thought my drumming reminded him of Mitch Mitchell, which something I'll never forget and was pretty amazing. And that was one of the shows that we did that I remember fondly back at. The third one, actually, we played, there was an anti-war demonstration. The Vietnam War was going on. And I think our country had invaded Cambodia and there was a lot of protests going on. And so we're always trying to find a place to play. So we offered to play at this anti-war demonstration, and it was in another little park in our town called Plaza Park, just actually right down the street from where Jarvis had his Frost and Fire festivals. Anyway, they set up a stage there, and there's three or four other bands. We were one of the first bands to play. I remember that being quite an exciting thing. I think back at the time, there was like some FBI agents that were up in the trees actually taking picture of all the demonstrators. The one thing I do remember, we were too young to drive, and Jerry's brother Richard drove our equipment van out. And I remember as we were driving out, after we loaded up our equipment, the police were moving in and shooting tear gas. And so that's how that went.
Yeah, I remember leaving the anti-war protest, seeing the police move in with tear gas. And I was thinking to myself, man, this music thing could be dangerous. One other short-lived gig we had, we were basically the soundtrack for a local community play based on The Hobbit. I definitely remember playing Jumping Jack Flash as part of the soundtrack and a few of our original songs, but I don't think the play went over too well. I think it closed after two performances, much to the relief of, I think, everyone involved.
So a lot of these early concerts, they were special and they were fun, and we got to play outdoors. To me, always playing outdoors was really a favorite thing for me, because hearing, you know, heavy metal music, real loud sound reinforcement, traveling outside, it really excites me and gets me going as a musician. Later on, after the band had been together for a while, we started playing more sophisticated venues, I guess you'd call them. In our local area, there'd be promoters that would put on concerts, mainly once again to get teenagers, you know, give them something to do. There was a gentleman, can't remember his name exactly, but he was a promoter. I think he ran a local radio station, and he'd always put on these battle of the bands. A bunch of bands would get together and you'd play like maybe over four different nights spread out through the summer season, you know, and then at the end they'd actually vote on which was the best band at the time. And we did a bunch of these battle of the bands, and I think a lot of the bands did it too. I'm not sure we ever expected to win or even wanted to win. We just wanted to get out and play music. we'd show up at these battles of the bands, bringing lots of amplification at the time, you know, play really loud, play all original material, which kind of blew other people away because they were playing, you know, mostly copy songs. You know, some of the bands were playing original stuff, and it was fun. You know, we could get out, we could blast the music. I think almost every time we played, we'd get, you know, between 200 and 300 local people showing up to see us. And we got quite a following because, you know, our music was pretty strong, not that much different than it is now. So we'd show up, we'd blast a crowd. You know, we'd always try to not take any prisoners. And, you know, it wasn't a competition in our mind, but what we wanted to do is go out and play as heavy music as possible.
These really early gigs that Rob's talking about, there's pictures of them in the subscriber section on nightdemon.net, so be sure to check that out. Now, through the 70s, the band recorded multiple demos, and with the addition of Tim Baker on vocals and Flint Vuja on bass, they cemented the lineup that would finally record what would become a future metal classic. Frost and Fire was recorded in 1980 and released in early 1981.
The seeds of what we would call Sirith Ungol's first album, Frost and Fire, were planted when we played another one of these Battle of the Bands on September 3rd, 1979. As I explained earlier, we played many of these battles over the years, never expecting to win. We just wanted to get out, play live, kick some ass with our music. As I mentioned, they were put on by a local promoter who ran a radio station. He's always looking for bands that he could book to play events, such as teen dances, what have you. And I think he always liked our band because we'd bring a whole group of people, enthusiastic crowd, to show up wherever we played. The Battle of the Bands that's associated with Frost and Fire, we actually billed, our name was spelled wrong. It was CIRUTH UNGLE, Kiruth Ungle or something like that. And ironically, we probably would have won the event, but the top band we were up against, and we knew some of the guys in that band, they were called Full Sail. When they went to go play, well, their guitarist amp wouldn't work. And so I remember back at the time, Jerry had a Music Man amp, you know, a tube amp. And so we loaned him the amp, which allowed them to play. And, you know, they were playing more like dance music, you know, which once again, these promoters wanted to put on dances where the kids would all come together, almost like a Happy Days event. We were lucky enough to come in second. And when we came in second, the prize actually was $500. We'd been recording a lot of stuff for years in our home little studio. That $500 actually gave us the motivation to actually go into a larger studio and actually do something that was more significant. That's kind of how the whole seed was planted for Frost and Fire. What we wanted to do was use that recording time to work on what we considered to be the ultimate demo that we could send out to record companies in an attempt to secure a recording contract. And also to the local larger LA clubs to get us in the door to play and possibly sell a few at local record stores. We wanted to make a complete album where the recording, mastering, and production was equal to or better than what any major label would have put out at a time. As for what the impact was of that album, I can't really say for sure. It was significant because it was the first album in our career. Heavy local radio station in Los Angeles, KLOS, they played us on a new music night. And I talked to the DJ the next day and he goes, look, man, this stuff is too heavy. That kind of blew us away because, you know, they were playing Black Sabbath and Deep Purple at the time. I don't think our music was too heavy. I think it was just they didn't understand it.
Yeah, Frost and Fire. It's kind of eclectic, actually. I actually like all the songs on there. I wish we'd been able to record it a little bit heavier, but that's partially due to our inexperience with a real recording studio, and it wasn't really a state-of-the-art place. But I think it's got three of our best songs on there. I'm Alive, Frost and Fire, and Edge of a Knife.
So 1981, Frost and Fire. I mean, the song, I guess Frost and Fire is probably my favorite off of that album. And it's just a great introduction into what you're going to get out of them. I think I'm Alive is a great follow-up to that as well. A Little Fire. Yeah, I would say Frost and Fire. And the introduction of, for me, hearing like the guitar playing of Jerry's style, man, it's just fucking really cool. And the guitar tones, I mean, it's so weird, but good. You know, that super kind of buzzy, like you plug your guitar into your mom's radio, you know, your dad's hi-fi, and that's what it sounds like, you know? Some people might say that they're not recorded well, or those albums sound like shit, but I know some of the guys themselves will say that, but I don't agree. I think it's unique, and that's what makes them who they are. If it was recorded, you know, any different, it just wouldn't sound right.
So Frost and Fire is released and gets a great reaction overseas, and slowly a large fan base begins to grow. But at home, it gets mixed reviews. Here's Tim Baker, vocalist Cirith Ungol.
That was never supposed to be an actual album, as most of you may or may not know. It was our attempt at getting some interest from record labels and promoters, and it was a self-financed effort on our part. As far as the impact that it made a bit of an impact here in the States, a little bit more in Europe. It got some good press, some bad press, but it really kind of got us started on our way.
Well, I remember holding the Frost and Fire album cover in my hands and just staring at it for what seemed like hours, man. I was so proud when it came out. We played at a number of places in the valley around that time. It was actually a kind of a local fanzine called New Heavy Metal Review. And remember, we were one of the cover boys for several issues of that magazine, along with like Motley Crue and some of the other, like Quiet Riot, some of the other early bands around then. So we had a little bit of publicity. And then a few months after the album came out and started getting shipped overseas, I'd see reviews of Cirith Ungol, of Frost and Fire. Of course, they were Italian, so I couldn't understand it. Funnily enough, in Kerrang! Magazine, I think the song Frost and Fire showed up in like the top 20 cuts of the week or the month or whatever it was. This was before the famous review where they called us the worst heavy metal band in history.
If you want to see pictures of some of these magazines, head over to the subscriber section on nightdemon.net. Here's Tim Baker.
Quite a mishmash of styles on that album. It's not really one of our heavier albums because it was a cross-section of what we were doing at the time, and we thought, you know, if we did that and put it out there, maybe it would generate some interest from the record companies, and of course it did not. So, I mean, in the long run, it worked out for us, but at the time, it didn't really make that big of an impact, but it was a good idea on our part.
Metal Blade Records presents the return of heavy metal legends Armored Saint with their 8th full-length album, Punching the Sky. A diverse, attitude-drenched collection, it's everything the band's faithful have come to expect from them while pushing their signature sound forward. Featuring 11 hard-hitting tracks available on double LP and Digipak CD. Right now, Metal Blade Records is giving all Night Demon Heavy Metal podcast listeners a 15% store-wide discount on all Metal Blade releases and merchandise. including this masterpiece from Armored Saint. Go to indiemerch.com/Metal Blade Records and enter promo code NDPODCAST at checkout. This store is loaded with tons of swag from some of the best bands in metal, like Midnight, Cirith Ungol, Merciful Fate, Angel Witch, Satan, and of course, the mighty Armored Saint. That's indiemerch.com/Metal Blade Records, promo code NDPODCAST. So march like a saint and take the last train home. Can you deliver?
In 1981, Brian Slagle, friend of the band, founds Metal Blade Records and decides to put out a compilation of unsigned underground metal bands.
How did we end up on Metal Massacre 1? Well, we knew Brian Slagle from his working at a record store that we used to frequent in L.A. And he was told us, you know, we helped each other out as far as, like, his first album goes, so... At the time, he had a fanzine going on, and he wanted to start a record label. He wanted us to have a song on his album, which is Metal Massacre 1, and his new label, Metal Blade. And we agreed to that, and little did we know how big Metal Blade would end up eventually becoming, like probably the biggest metal label in the world. And, in hindsight, we should have just stayed with him on Metal Blade, but who knew at the time? I mean, we were kind of committed to the other guys that we were with at the time, but that's how we ended up on it. We were just friends with Brian, and he was looking for bands to put on his first album, and since, you know, he loved our band, we were good friends, and we all got together and agreed to do it.
So in 1982, Metal Blade's first compilation is released, Metal Massacre. If you're a NightDemon.net subscriber, you can view the actual contract that was signed by Cirith Ungol with Metal Blade Records. That's in the subscriber section on NightDemon.net. But most metal fans have heard of this compilation. Featured Steeler, Bitch, Rat, first recorded appearance of Metallica, which is spelled with two T's on this compilation, but also features the Cirith Ungol track Death of the Sun.
Oh,
Despite the band's efforts to appeal to record labels by smoothing out their rough edges, the music industry establishment dismisses Frost and Fire for being far too heavy. So instead, Cirith Ungol resolved to make the heaviest record they possibly could. Around then, Greg Lindstrom departs, and now the four-piece Cirith Ungol decides to record their heaviest offering yet, which they pay for, record, and mix themselves. King of the Dead.
King of the Dead. Fucking Finger of Scorn, man. Again, as I've mentioned before in other podcasts, I'm a fan of the classical kind of guitar playing thing, and that guitar part in that song is just so beautiful and haunting and medieval and all that good stuff. I think this is probably the best album, in my opinion, for them. I mean, all the songs on it are just fucking bangers, for sure. Cirith Ungol, Atom Smasher, Black Machine, Master of the Pit. Black Machine is a good one. It's one of my favorites. Burly white behind back-drawn lips.
After Frost and Fire was played on the local radio station, KLOS, we were told it was way too heavy to play on their air, so we decided to pull out all the stops and on our second album to release some of our heaviest material, resulting in King of the Dead.
King of the Dead, yeah, it's obviously the best album. A lot of the material is predates Frost and Fire, like Atom Smasher, Finger of Scorn, Cirith Ungol. But, you know, all the songs are killer and no filler.
Greg had recently left the band to pursue a different path in the city of Lost Angeles. Once again, we had complete control over every facet of this creation, and we were determined to forge this fresh batch of molten metal into the heaviest metal known to man. It was released on Enigma Records in the U.S. and Roadrunner Records abroad. It meant a great deal of us to have released a second album, and we received some critical journalistic recognition, but once again, the widespread exposure we sought eluded us.
So remember, this was the mid-80s. It was peak hair metal in L.A. at the time. The record label Enigma suddenly had success with Motley Crue, Rat, and Poison. pretty much the antithesis of Cirith Ungol's dark, apocalyptic sound. Enigma actually hooked them up with a manager who was pushing for them to change their look and wear makeup and go glam, like to fit into the current trends in metal in L.A. at the time. But I'll quote Robert Garvin when he said, "Hype, gimmicks, fads, not our thing. Heavy metal in its true and elemental form was our goal and our life's mission." So Cirith Ungol left Enigma and went to Metal Blade Records with longtime friend Brian Slagle.
After King of the Dead, we weren't sure how to move on. Those years were one of struggle and heartbreak, trying to promote the band with little outside help. The band spent many tireless nights rehearsing and writing new material and answering the ever-increasing hordes of fan mail. We decided to leave Enigma and join our longtime friend Brian Slagle, who had formed Metal Blade Records.
Now with Metal Blade Records, the band records their next album, One Foot in Hell. It was similar in style to King of the Dead in heaviness, but it had more compact, mature arrangements. One thing to note about this album is Jerry Fogle's guitar work.
He ever got his due, or at least he never got to see that himself. I do believe that, you know, his epic riff writing and his guitar solos have definitely lived on through the first three Cirith Ungol records. But just Jerry's lead playing was just so amazing. And if you watch any of those old live videos, it's just some of the improvisation that he does on the solos are just so incredible. I mean, he's a magical guitar player. And in my mind, he was a musical genius.
Even though One Foot in Hell was strong and a success musically for the band, any kind of financial or commercial success was still beyond our reach. The band was tired of long nights of working at our secret lair with few concert dates played. This took a toll on the band, and Jerry left the band, followed by Flint.
So Fogle and Flint both quit, leaving Garvin and Baker to forge ahead. So three albums in, even though amassing a fan base overseas, financial success still eludes them. So now down to two members, the band needs to decide if they want to forge ahead in Los Angeles's cutthroat, image-driven club scene. As this quote from Rob Garvin says, "It is just sad when we were working together and kicking ass and no one wanted us to play anywhere." Well, that's it for part one. Tune in next week for part two, the appearance of Jim Barraza, Paradise Lost album, and the breakup of the band, which resulted in a 25-year hiatus and a blood oath to never play music again. And we'll also learn of the details of how their friendship with Night Demon led to their resurrection and triumphant return to the world stage. Be sure to check out the bonus section on nightdemon.net for bonus content, including pictures and old magazine covers from the early days, the full unreleased interview with the band from 1982 when they played Mexico, and full live audio from Cirith Ungol's 1984 Los Angeles show. So until next time, this is Nesbitt, signing off.
Thanks for listening to the Night Demon Heavy Metal Podcast. Head over to nightdemon.net, click on the subscriber tab, and sign up to access exclusive weekly bonus content. If you would like to donate to support the Night Demon Heavy Metal Podcast, you can do so through PayPal at paypal.me/nightdemonmetal. Additionally, if you have not already done so, please subscribe, like, rate, and review the show on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Unbearable suspense keeps you on the edge of an abyss of terror.
Take a cult film odyssey into cinemadness with Cinematic Void. Based in Los Angeles, Cinematic Void is a film series that specializes in horror and exploitation films. Currently, we are hosting Cinematic Void Up All Night in the Cinemadness Movie, a monthly virtual screening series, as well as the Cinematic Void podcast, where we dive deeper into the world of cult cinema. You can find Cinematic Void on the World Wide Web at cinematicvoid.com, as well as Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And if you like what we do, you can support Cinematic Void by joining our Patreon. Until next time, see you in the void.